Today we're going to take a look at two different dreshot from the Eish Kodesh, which will help, I think, kind of begin to address some questions that center maybe a bit around doubt, and then also some significant questions about speech and silence. And so we'll look at these two dreshot, and then we'll also see a bit from Rav Soloveitchik that can sort of expand on our notions of the meaning of speech and its significance. So this first drasha, which comes from Parshat Metsora, that deals with tzaraat, often translated as leprosy, but it's really not the medical condition of leprosy. And to understand this first, we're going to take a look at the background set of psukim verses that the Eish Kodesh references. And so here we read at the beginning in Vayikra Yud Daled, 14th chapter of Vayikra, God spoke to Moshe and Aaron, saying, "When you enter the land of Canaan that I give you as a possession, and I inflict an eruptive plague, this being tzaraat, upon a house in the land you possess, the owner of the house shall come and tell the priest, saying, 'Something like a plague has appeared upon my house.'" So tzaraat can afflict one's body, one's skin, can also afflict one's clothing, and also one's home. "The priest shall order the house cleared before the priest enters to examine the plague, so that nothing in the house may become impure. After that, the priest shall enter to examine the house. If, when he examines the plague in the walls of the house is found to consist of greenish or reddish streaks that appear to go deep into the wall, the priest shall come out of the house to the entrance of the house and close up the house for 7 days. On the seventh day, the priest shall return. If he sees that the plague has spread on the walls of the house, the priest shall order the stones with the plague in them to be pulled out and cast outside the city into an impure place. The house shall be scraped inside all around, and the coating that is scraped off shall be dumped outside the city in an impure place. They shall take other stones and replace those stones with them, and take other coating and plaster the house. If the plague again breaks out in the house, after the stones have been pulled out and after the house has been scraped and replastered, the priest shall come to examine. If the plague has spread in the house, it is a malignant eruption in the house, it is impure. The house shall be torn down, its stones and timbers, and all the coating on the house, and taken to an impure place outside the city." So we can spend a lot of time looking at the various commentaries on what's going on here. I think this is one of the more unusual set of psukim in the Torah, this whole phenomenon of tzaraat in general, and specifically tzaraat in one's home. But Rashi, quoting the Midrash, offers, I'd say, a rather surprising and also an almost delightfully surprising explanation for what's going on here. Rashi says, "This was an announcement to them that these plagues would come upon them, the plagues of tzaraat, because the Amorites concealed treasures of gold in the walls of their house during the 40 years the Israelites were in the wilderness. And in consequence of the plague, they would pull down the house and discover them." So it seems here that according to Rashi, again following the Midrash, as the residents of Canaan, the Amorites, heard that the Israelites were approaching, it seems like, in preparation for a potential battle and conquest, they hid their precious items, their riches, in the walls of their home. And so what happens here? As the Israelites eventually arrive, there's all this treasure that they don't know about once they conquer Israel or Canaan. And this whole mechanism of this tzaraat for one's home is actually a way for the Israelites to eventually get these riches that the Amorites had left behind. Intriguing explanation, and one that puts a very positive spin on tzaraat here. This is the background, and we'll quote again here for the Eish Kodesh. So the Eish Kodesh writes, and this is still relatively early on. I think we started with our first drasha, our first sermon was September of 1939. So this is, I guess around 7, 8 months later. Eish Kodesh writes, "When you come into the land of Canaan, etc., and I place a plague of leprosy upon a house in the land of your possession," as we've seen, Rashi explains, "This is good news for you, because the Amorites had hidden caches of gold in their houses, and through the plague, the house is demolished and the treasure is discovered." So the Eish Kodesh now wants to build off of this. He writes, "We must therefore understand why was the house first shut up for 7 days, and only after were the stones removed? For once the plague was seen, it was already known that there was a hidden cache there." I guess the idea here seems to be if we've determined over time that the Tzaraat was kind of this almost divine, magical way of discerning where these treasures were. So once there was some sign of Tzaraat, the Eish Kodesh here is wondering why there needs to be a kind of 7 day waiting period. Seems like you should just be able to jump right in and see the good that is within this apparent plague or affliction. And especially since, as the Ramban explains, and as is brought in the writings of my holy father and teacher, my master, the Rebbe of blessed memory, just recall that he didn't have a real lived experience with his father who died when he was still a toddler. My father said, "Plagues of houses and garments are not natural phenomena." Right? This isn't just some medical thing that's happening, which maybe the tzaraat of one's skin, we could say, is some kind of skin affliction or infection and describe it naturally, but certainly the tzaraat of these materials is not natural. And thus, they are entirely for the benefit of Israel in order to reveal the hidden treasures. If so, why did the Torah command that the house first be rendered impure for 7 days? Now, and just already clearly lurking in the background, right, implicitly, is we have this thing that appears like it is not good, a plague, and yet ultimately it leads to some kind of treasure. So we can see that what the Rebbe is probably contemplating here is, and he'll get more explicit in a moment, but we already, I think, should have this in mind from the very beginning, that he's talking to a bunch of people who are going through a certain kind of affliction, certain kind of plague, much worse. And so this parsha might in some way try and be inspiring a sense that there's actually something good that rests within it. Now, we have no grasp of the intentions of the Torah and its commandments, but what it hints to us, perhaps, is as follows. We know and believe that whatever God does to us, even when, God forbid, he smites us, it is all for the good. So now he is stating this theology explicitly. But when we see now that God is smiting us, not only with physical torments, but also in ways which, God forbid, distance us from him. For instance, there is no cheder for school children. There's no yeshiva for older adults. No Beit HaMidrash, a house of study where they would also pray for communal prayer. No mikveh, and so on. And God forbid a doubt, a suspicion enters our hearts. Could it be that now, too, his intention is for good? So underlying this is the Rebbe's understanding that if we want to try and find some kind of positive in suffering, the best way to kind of see that would be if that suffering leads one to a greater closeness with God. So perhaps if we saw a little bit from the very beginning, the first drasha that we saw, a sense that one's suffering evokes a certain kind of fear, and that fear can be a fear of God. Then there's kind of a positive religious orientation that can come from the suffering itself. What seems to be now puzzling the Rebbe is, okay, I can make that argument if the suffering we have at least provides us with an opportunity to serve God. But look at the suffering that we are experiencing around us. This suffering, right, is very clear that it's actually diminishing our religious lives. None of these communal religious institutions exist because of the German occupation. And so it becomes much more difficult to see how somehow the suffering has a piece of good within it. By the way, I mentioned this last week. This is another one of the few examples, which is somewhat rare, where the Rebbe actually mentions explicitly things that are happening in the ghetto. So we saw last time a situation talking about where beards were being forcibly shaved off. And here now we are seeing more specific elements of what life is like. But often the Rebbe delivers his message without explicit reference to what's happening, although much more implicit. We think if it were for the good, he should have afflicted us in ways which bring us closer to God, not by calling a halt to Torah study and prayer. Indeed, the calling a halt to almost the entire way of Torah life, God forbid. Could this be anything other than afflictions expressing divine rejection of us, God forbid? So we see here now a dramatic turn. The Rebbe wants to be able to understand afflictions as a way of orienting us towards God, because that doesn't seem possible by the nature of what life is like in the ghetto. He seems to be saying that the most obvious answer potentially is that God is rejecting us, right? If we suffer, but there are ways in which we can still come close to God, well, that might be hard for us to handle, both at the time and also currently theologically. But at the very least, there might be a way in which people can see that the relationship with God can at least grow closer. But once there are none of these institutions, what seems as if the only purpose must be that God has rejected us, God is distancing God's self from us. So the Rebbe continues. Therefore, we see in the Torah that although the plague of houses was impure and conveyed impurity, nevertheless, God made use of it for the benefit of Israel. First, the house was rendered impure for 7 days, and afterward, the hidden treasure was revealed. So the Rebbe is trying to argue, right? This is its own, there's a little bit of analogy here, but this is the Tzaraat was its own kind of affliction. The fact that it was rendered a person impure seems like it is also creating this kind of distance between a person and God. So it's not a kind of affliction that can immediately orient a person towards God and make them closer. Nevertheless, that's for these 7 days, and eventually good can come from it. So the Rebbe's argument here is, if in fact, remember the original question is, if in fact the Tzaraat of homes is meant to reveal this treasure, so it's ultimately for the good for the people, well, he doesn't understand why there should be this 7 day period in which there is impurity. And now he's arguing here, this is teaching us a certain kind of lesson, which is applicable to the people in the ghetto, that there can be a kind of suffering which, at least for some temporary period of time, doesn't seem to actually foster a deeper relationship with God. And yet, at the conclusion, after some wait period, it can, in fact, still be spiritually beneficial. The Rebbe then concludes, therefore, the individual cannot really say if something is a plague or a calamity. The only thing he can say is that it seems like a plague to him. The truth, however, is that it is a good for Israel. God will bestow good upon us. There's an interesting play that the Rebbe has here, which goes back to the original verses that we saw, that he says it appears, the Kohen, I think, says that it appears as if it is a plague. One reason why I think Rashi says this, why they say this, is because you don't want to actually make a definitive statement, which might then automatically render something further, have further impurity from the beginning. So you want to express some kind of epistemological doubt here, some kind of uncertainty. What the Rebbe here is trying to say, I think there are two pieces to this. One is that there can be a kind of period in which temporarily there is a distancing from God. There's a suffering that doesn't have a clear benefit, and yet later on that can shift. But also, I think what the Rebbe here is saying is if we try and take the zoomed out picture such that ultimately this is for the good, so its totality is positive, nevertheless, that doesn't override our felt experience that this is actually a plague in the moment. But it's not at its core essentially a plague. It is essentially something that is good. And yet we can't see that. So what do? We can acknowledge the subjective experience and say that this appears like it is a plague. So I think what the Rebbe is trying to do in this moment is he's trying to express a kind of faith or hope that from a zoomed out perspective, everything that the people are experiencing in the ghetto will somehow be for the good. And he's expressing that kind of faith. At the same time, he is affirming, I think, for his community, but I think also for himself, the very subjective reality that this appears like a plague. And so he wants to hold both at the same time. So he wants people to be able to say, this feels plague-like, but he also wants people to say that it's only apparently that way, that there can actually be a deeper objective reality. And so I think there's something which is very beautiful there. Often, I think in moments of suffering, we can kind of be caught between the validation of our immediate experience and some kind of hope or faith for something to improve. And sometimes if you try and only think about the hope and faith for something to get better, that can actually undermine and diminish and really suppress one's immediate experience. And at the same time, if one gets entirely caught up in the experience of their suffering, then it can be very hard to have hope or faith that something can get better. And so there's a beautiful sort of subtle element here, orientation here, that we can hold both by saying this is apparently a plague, that's how it appears to us, and yet holding a faith that actually, from a zoomed out perspective, after some amount of time, there may be a way to see the good here. Now, again, this is still relatively early. And as I mentioned before, and we'll get into this in subsequent classes, as the Shoah progresses and is prolonged and things get worse, the Rebbe will begin to offer a very different kind of theology. But at this moment, at least, he is trying, I think, to hold both the faith in something getting better, that this actually could somehow be for the positive, while also acknowledging and validating the very subjective experience that this is plague-like.
This may answer a general suffering. What about the individual who's not only suffers but is killed from this? It ignores the individual suffering and saying, but it teaches us a greater lesson. And it's hard for me to accept that. I'm sorry.
So I think that's a good point. Right, there are different drashot that we've also seen, right? So we saw one, that was last week or 2 weeks ago, about, it was 2 weeks ago, about dying al pi kiddush Hashem, right? Sort of martyrdom. So that might be one way in which the Rebbe, I think, was addressing that particular point. So I think I would say that in this particular drasha, he's not so much discussing that aspect of dying. And one thing also, I think, to remember, right, is the Rebbe is delivering these as drashot, even though he edited them later. And just like a rabbi in a shul today will offer different messages at different times and isn't always saying the same thing. The kind of full philosophy or theology or ideology they're trying to convey can only be done sort of with the collection of their drashot. So I think my best response to what you're offering here is, it's not something that the Rebbe is addressing at this particular moment in this particular drasha, but something that he addresses in other times and other moments. So here, I think he's talking to the people who are living and suffering, not talking as much about preparing them to die as we saw before. And certainly, that part of their suffering is the mourning for their, relatives who came before, who died before them. But it's not addressing so much the goodness that can, in theory, maybe, or how the Rebbe would find goodness in death itself.
So I'm curious whether, in making this analogy between the plague, the house plague, and the destruction, the sort of catastrophic destruction of their means of practicing their religion, of practicing Judaism, does the Rebbe ever come to make then a connection or an analogy to the destruction of the temple, and which necessitated a reef, a sort of going back to the sources and a reformulation of Jewish practice? Does he ever move in that direction?
That's great. I was actually thinking of a very long drasha for today that very much is exactly what you're saying. And so I think we'll take a look at that either in our next class or in our final class. So you can hold on for that. But I think that's a great point. And I hadn't even thought so much about, in general, kind of the physical nature of this house being taken apart and the physical buildings being destroyed and the physical Beit HaMikdash, the temple being destroyed, and also that these are really institutions of Jewish life. So we'll take a look about how the Rebbe thinks about destruction of the temple, and how we should orient ourselves towards that phenomenon. So if no more questions or comments on this, we'll move to another drasha here. This one from Parshat Vayeshev, and I think also just what I want to say, and I mentioned this as we were going, but I also want to highlight this a bit also, is you do really hear a sense of doubt, I think, in the Rebbe's voice there, that it seems as if he has a kind of, he's coming in with a certain kind of theology of how suffering can be beneficial. And he's already really beginning to question that when he sees that these institutions of Jewish life, and I'd say by Jewish practice in general, have really been seriously damaged by being in the ghetto. And that is, I think, already causing the Rebbe to rework his theology. And he's done so in this particular drasha. But I think it's also important to highlight the sense of that these existing frameworks that he had no longer seem to be helpful or something that he himself can believe. And so he now has to work out a new theology. And then we'll see that in more extreme ways as we progress in our course. So for Parshat Vayeshev, the parsha begins, Jacob settled in the land where his father had sojourned, the land of Canaan. And Rashi there comments and says, Jacob wished to live in tranquility, but the troubles with Joseph suddenly came upon him. Right? So we think about Yaakov, Jacob's life. Until this point, everything that happens with his sons, he's already had a rather dramatic life. Everything with Esav and deceiving his father and having to run away, his, you know, the whole deception that takes place also by Laban, his father-in-law, and him trying to marry Rachel and Leah. And Jacob's life is one which is really full of torment. And we can see here that as Jacob is now aged, he's kind of hoping that he will finally be able to kind of live out some years, some decades in tranquility. And then, of course, that doesn't happen, and perhaps the most harrowing parts of his life are still yet to come. Rashi continues, when the righteous wish to live in tranquility, the Holy One, blessed be He, says, is it not enough for the righteous what has been prepared for them in the world to come, that they also wish to live in tranquility in this world? So essentially, the way Rashi is understanding this is to say that the life of a tzaddik, who is granted a portion in the world to come, but in this world, it's going to be one which is wholly, entirely one of some kind of suffering, some kind of toil. There won't be tranquility, which itself is a harsh statement, I think, especially in this particular context where the pain and suffering that Yaakov is going to have is not just kind of working yourself to the ground for the sake of something positive, but it's a deep emotional suffering. And basically what Rashi is saying here is even that you shouldn't expect anything positive in this world. So with that as the background for what the Eish Kodesh is going to share, that itself I think is still significant, right? Tzaddik in Hasidic times takes on a kind of a greater role. What Rashi's referring to is just a righteous person, but the tzaddik in the Hasidic realm is someone who really is on a higher spiritual level, and that comes along with a lot of responsibility towards his flock. And already, in some ways, we can see potentially that the Rebbe, by referencing this at the outset, maybe talking a little bit to himself of his own sense of that there he has no tranquility and just suffering. So Eish Kodesh quotes this, right? Jacob settled in the area where his father had lived in the land of Canaan. Rashi explains Jacob wanted to live in serenity, but the anguish of Joseph leapt upon him. Righteous people want to live in serenity in this world, but the Holy One says to them, is it not enough that you'll enjoy serenity in the world to come, that you should want it in this world as well? My father and my teacher, His Holiness Reb Elimelech. Once again, we see him quoting his father. And again, he would have really only known his father through his teachings, not personally. My father, of blessed memory, comments on this in his writing, asking if God's answer to righteous people, as explained by Rashi, does not hold more than just a simple, obvious meaning. Would God really say this to righteous people? I heard from my holy father-in-law, the righteous and holy one of blessed memory, regarding the song. Now, this is fascinating. The Rebbe here is trying to learn out theology from a Shabbos zemer, a song that one would sing on Shabbat, which is very interesting. Usually, you know, we can kind of mine those in some way, but they don't hold the same level of authority. So, just an interesting choice. That song says, "Help those who rest on the seventh day in plowing." Now, this word plowing or harisha can also mean silence, and that's really the significance of what we're about to see. Then it refers to those who observe Shabbat in their plowing. Now, really, what that would mean is refraining from plowing, which is one of the 39 prohibited activities on Shabbat. But he says that is those who do not speak about it at all. And then this is his end quote of what his father-in-law was saying. It is obvious, for it is taught in Shabbat on the verse and speaking a matter that you're not supposed to speak about mundane weekly things on Shabbat, that one's speech on Shabbat should not be like one's speech on the weekday. There's a different kind of speech, and this is what the song itself is referring to, people who rest on Shabbat, not just from the physically prohibited things, but also people whose speech on Shabbat is different from the week. But he continues. But it's also possible to explain that it refers to those righteous individuals who ascend so greatly on Shabbat that they are unable to speak what they apprehend and feel. So the Rebbe is moving away now from a sense of how do you kind of engage in Shabbat-like speech? Well, you do so by not talking about weekday things, by business, etc. And now he's offering another understanding that this is referencing people who attain such a ecstatic state on Shabbat from such a spiritual high that their words fail them. They're unable to describe those experiences. Help in plowing, referring to the zemer, to the song, in silence due to the greatness of the spiritual apprehension. And now the Rebbe says, what I think is the crux and so significant. He says, there is a difference between the Hebrew words harish, silence, and almut, muteness. Right? Until now, he's been talking about harish. When the Torah uses the word harish, there is generally, or harisha, there is generally plenty to be said, but the subject refrains from speaking. Right? So this would be a person who has elevated themselves to such a high spiritual state. There's plenty to say, but they just don't have the right words to be able to express it. That is a certain kind of silence. For example, when Mordechai tells Esther, if you remain silent at this time, we'll read this in just a few weeks, im acharish tacharishi, then relief and deliverance will appear for the Jews from elsewhere, but you and your father's house will perish. Right? So in that case, it's a certain kind of silence that if Esther refrains from speaking, but there's what to be said. Or with Moshe, where he says to the Jews on the banks of the Red Sea, God will fight for you and you will be silent, tacharishun, and so forth. He's basically saying there's a certain kind of standard silence, just remaining quiet. But one could say something if they had the right words or if they wanted to. In all of these examples, there's plenty that might have been said, but people were silent. And now is the key here. Very different is the Jewish person who is, God forbid, so broken and crushed that he has nothing to say, who does not appreciate or understand what is happening to him, who does not possess the faculties with which to assess or assimilate his experiences, who no longer has the mind or the heart with which to incorporate the experience. For him, silence is not a choice. His is the muteness of one incapable of speech. So there's a different kind of lack of speaking, which he's calling muteness. And this is really someone who is so broken, so overwhelmed by their experience, that it's not just that they can't find the right words, but there's a much deeper, all-encompassing kind of silence that they don't even really process what's going on. The Rebbe continues. There are times, it is understood by the Jews, when survival means being reduced, God forbid, to petty, small-minded, and spiritually diminished behavior. Then the Jew cheers himself, adapts, and adjusts to the times and the difficulties until the wrath passes. He says to himself, it is true that now I am mute, but even a mute can communicate a little with grunts and gestures. I will speak a little in this way, communicating even in my muteness. When, however, the sufferings of the Jewish people continue growing, and everyone is even more broken, and more crushed. Then we reach the level we read of in this week's portion. Joseph describes the first dream to his brothers. Behold, he tells them, we are binding sheaves in the field. Then my sheaf stood up erect, and your sheaves surrounded it and bowed down to mine. That's Joseph's dream. The Hebrew for the word binding of sheaves is almim alumim, which is identical to the Hebrew word for being made mute. As though Joseph had said, we were struck mute in the field. It's already just a powerful description here, right? You have, and this is a very far, this is a stretch of a read of this text, although you have the linguistic word here, which is very nice. But the Rebbe now is talking to his people, and he's basically saying that you're so broken, you're in this state of muteness, and actually Joseph's dream is also a state of where everyone is mute. Joseph explains the prophetic meaning of his dream as follows. We were harvesting the field when the exile reached the state of me'almim alumim, muteness that is mute. We were bereft of the ability to communicate, even in our Torah and our worship of God. This is a silence of silence, a complete muteness. Then behold, alumati, my muteness, which again, the literal translation here would be his sheaf, but my muteness suddenly stood up erect. At first, I tried bending my shoulders to the yoke, thinking to adjust myself to the difficulties and to live a life of muteness. But when I saw that even my muteness was mute, I could not bear it. I took the courage to cry out to God even louder when Alamotechem, your muteness, the brothers, surrounded mine, and you took strength from me. This is the meaning of the original quote from Rashi with which we began this chapter. Righteous people want to live in serenity in this world. They want to adjust and adapt themselves to the exile and troubles, basically just to let it pass. But the Holy One, blessed be He, says, it is not enough for the righteous to be satisfied that the future will be good, that they will survive. Even now, they must toil to arouse heavenly mercy so that God will save Israel immediately. This is not an easy drasha, but I think what's happening here for the Rebbe is he's essentially saying that there is this kind of broken down muteness and the kind of example of Joseph, of Yosef here, is that somehow out of this state of muteness, there is still, he has an ability to cry out to God. And I think, right, in this case, there may be a shift which is taking place, which is not so obvious. The original tzaddik that's being referred to, I think, in Rashi is Jacob. But I think there's a shift here, which is happening at least in this dream, where that is now shifted to being Yosef, to be Joseph. And I think in this way, the Rebbe is kind of finding himself. He's portraying himself as being this sheaf, this mute, and the people are also mute. And I think what he's trying to argue here, he's first trying to very poignantly acknowledge the kind of broken downness, inability to, not just inability to say words, but something which is even deeper, and almost inability to have a primordial cry to God. And yet I think he sees it as his own responsibility to be like Joseph here, that he needs to somehow cry out to God. And once he is able to do that, then I think the idea is that it can inspire the other people to cry out to God. So from his muteness, there's kind of a cry from that state of muteness, which seems paradoxical. But if he can kind of find that way and show that way to the people who here are being analogized to the brothers, then they'll also be able to find a way to also cry out to God. But I think there's something which is it's so powerful here in the Rebbe's use of this, of both first coming up with multiple kinds of silence as a way of, I think, really emphasizing the depth of this latter kind of silence and what we're calling muteness. But also, I think the Rebbe is trying to find for himself, within himself. First of all, he's acknowledging, I think, that he himself is mute, and that is itself deeply, I mean, very sad, but also powerful. And yet, I think the Rebbe is almost trying to encourage himself to say that even from this sense of muteness, I can find a way to cry out. And the way he's tying this into the Rashi of the tzaddik is he's basically arguing that there might be a model where essentially someone suffers and they're able to kind of withstand the suffering because they're just gonna let it pass, and eventually new epic, a new period or epoch will arrive when this kind of state of extreme suffering and a certain kind of exile will be no longer. And then you can find redemption in God. And I think what he's trying to argue here is that he's trying to encourage himself to say, it's not just that I'm going to withstand the suffering I have now and hopefully I'll survive and we'll be able to rebuild, but there also needs to be a way to communicate with God even in this moment. And from my muteness, I need to find a way to still cry out to God. And if I can do that, then the people around me, from their muteness, from their broken down state, will also be able to cry out to God. And so this to me is very powerful because I think we hear in a certain way the Rebbe admitting his own brokenness and yet his desire to still find a way. By the way, that's what the tzaddik is also meant to do in general in the Hasidic world. The tzaddik is meant to also lead by example, but also in a way plead on behalf of the people. And so he wants to be this kind of Yosef-like figure where he can go ahead and cry out to God. And maybe that'll change the circumstances or will allow the people also to cry out as well. But he's admitting his own brokenness, and I think really trying to, first and foremost, support and encourage himself, and then through that, to support and encourage his people. The scholar James Diamond discusses this, and he writes, a more appropriate term for this kind of silence is Andre Neher's nocturnal meta-silence or non-silence of some 22:3, which you also have below, which he defines as more silent than silence. It is the fall of silence into a deeper stratum of nothingness. It is a shaft hollowed out beneath silence, which leads to its most vertiginous depths. I think that's a beautiful and harrowing description. At the same time, I think the Rebbe is trying to find a way from that state of nothingness to be able to still call out and commune with God. So I want to take your questions or comments on this, and then I want to take a look at a part of an essay from Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik.
But what the question I wanted to raise is the dream about the sheet, the grain that the rabbi quotes in here. But after that passage in Vayeshev, the next passage is his brothers answered, "Do you mean to reign over us? Do you mean to rule over us?" And they hated him even more for his talk about his dreams. So it seems that he's sort of taking it out of context in some sense, because they don't gather, the brothers at least don't gather strength from this. They end up hating him even more. So, literally taking the both sentences together, one might conclude that the biblical passage suggests that, in fact, his followers might hate him further for, trying. In other
Sure.
words, he leaves that out.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's a very astute point. And in general, in many Hasidic writings, it is common to take things out of, very much out of context like that, and to try and find some kind of narrow midrash or some set of verses, sometimes even just a couple of words, a phrase, and really read into that and build off of that drasha or general conceptual point, where if seen in context, that can, undermine the point itself. So I think what you're saying is 100% correct. And this is just the genre of this kind of teaching, which is not meant to be holistic in its context, but actually sort of drawing this material in a very narrow way, decontextualized to make a broader point.
This is so moving, and but from both all of them we've studied so far, just feeling the struggle he seems to be undergoing to try to stay connected to life, and especially with the speech, Like it goes back to Bereshit, God created the world, through speech. And here he is, it's just very powerful. So thank you. I don't have a question per se, but just wanted to
Thank you.
express that.
Thank you. And it's nice to see you on Shabbat.
Yeah, it was great.
So we can jump into the Rav now, Rav Joseph Soloveitchik, who grew up in Europe, but left before the war, was kind of the founding father of modern Orthodoxy in the United States, settled in Boston and taught at Yeshiva University. So he has an essay called Redemption Prayer Talmud Torah, where he talks about speech. And I first learned this with Rabbi Shai Held from Hadar many years ago. He writes, redemption, we have stated, is identical with communing, or with the revelation of the word, i.e. the emergence of speech. When a people leaves a mute world and enters a world of sound, speech, and song, it becomes a redeemed people, a free people. In other words, a mute life is identical with bondage. A speech-endowed life is a free life. The slave lives in silence, if such a meaningless existence may be called life. He has no message to deliver. In contrast with the slave, the free man bears a message, has a good deal to tell, and is eager to convey his life story to anyone who cares to listen. No wonder the Torah has four times emphasized the duty of the father, a liberated slave, to tell his children born into freedom the story of his liberation. Free man who is eager to tell his story is always surrounded by an audience willing to listen to his story. The slave has neither a story nor a curious audience. Moreover, he is not merely a speechless being, but a mute being, devoid not only of the word, but of the meaningful sound as well. What is responsible for the dumbness of the slave? The lack of a basic experience, namely that of suffering or distress, which is perhaps the central aspect of the human eye awareness. Suffering is not pain. Though colloquially the two words are used as synonyms, they signify two different experiences. Pain is a natural sensation, a physiological reaction of the organism to any kind of abnormality or tissue pathology. It is, as Aristotle always knew, a built-in mechanical signal that warns man wherever his physical existence is menaced from within. It is an integral part of the body's security system. Pain, as instinctual reaction, is immediate and non-reflective. As such, it is not restricted to humans. The beast is also exposed to and acquainted with pain. Suffering or distress, in contradistinction to pain, is not a sensation, but an experience, a spiritual reality known only to humans. The animal does not suffer. This spiritual reality is encountered by man whenever he stands to lose either his sense of existential security, as in the case of an incurable disease, or his existential dignity, as in the case of public humiliation. Whenever a merciless reality clashes with the human existential awareness, man suffers and finds himself in distress. The animal is exposed to pain, so is the slave. When the slave meets with pain, he reacts like the animal, uttering a sharp, shrill sound. However, the howl of the beast, like the shriek of the slave, lasts a moment in the darkness and hush of the night. In a split second, all is silent again. There is no aftermath to the pain sensation of the animal or the slave. There follows no complaint, no request, no protest, no question of why and what. The slave does not know suffering, lacking as he is the very existential need awareness which generates suffering. He is never in distress because he has no human needs. The needs of a slave are, like his shriek, not human. The etiology of his needs is exclusively biological. The absence of suffering mitigates the sharpness of pain. Former inmates of concentration camps have told me that they had, with the passage of time, become inured to any pain or torture, as if they had been totally anesthetized. They were dumb beings. They not only stopped speaking, but ceased to emit coherent sounds as well. And I thought of this passage from Rav Soloveitchik for two reasons. There's a way in which, especially his conclusion, seems to be giving further voice to what the Rebbe is saying, the sense of being so broken that you're completely mute. And that for Rav Soloveitchik, that is kind of the defining characteristic of a slave, not necessarily someone who is enslaved, but I think of more kind of existential character of a slave. And what it means to be free is to be able to speak and to process. And the Rebbe himself, I think, is saying something very similar. And what he's trying to encourage himself with this drasha is to be able to still be free and to still offer some kind of words, even from the midst of his suffering. I think the other piece, which to me is in some ways consoling, that even as the Rebbe is talking about the inability to speak, both about his community and I think himself, he is actually speaking. He is offering a way to process, even if that process is expressing doubt and talking about paradoxically an inability to speak. He is still putting, giving, offering expression, offering words. And so there's a way that I think very profoundly, the Rebbe is still living as a free person. This drasha specifically and the drashot more generally are his way of still being a free person in this definition, of still being able to offer these words to articulate something about his experience, to reflect on the experience. And that doesn't mitigate neither the physical pain nor the emotional or psychological pain, but it helps prevent him from being completely eviscerated as a human being and turned into this other existential category of being a slave. And so, again, this doesn't ignore by any means the actual suffering that's happening, but I think there's a way in which for the Rebbe, this is a heroic move. Again, both this drasha, but also all of his drashot, all of his writings. There's a heroism in his willingness to still be able to speak to his community and then to write down what he's been sharing, to share that with others. That is the, I think, in my mind, kind of the core element, light of redemption, the Rebbe was able to be in a ghetto and to model for us and for his community as well. We've got a couple minutes for some further reflections or questions. So please feel free.
Okay, I have not figured out what this means yet, but I'm thinking about the Buddhist conception of suffering and the imperative to go beyond suffering because existence is pain, but we add to it when we protest against the pain and then we suffer. So it's like a different worldview. And like I said, I have not processed how it's different or what it means that it's different, but it's just a contrast.
Yeah, I think that's really, thank you for pointing that out. The idea that we can become detached from suffering, and I think for Rav Soloveitchik here, maybe the Rebbe also, it's actually dafka being able to write about and contemplate and reflect on our suffering. It won't go away, but that's what makes us free.
I think I'm recognizing Chareisha, the same root of Cheresh, a person who is deaf. And so my mind is going to the significance of muteness versus deafness. And I wonder if.
I think Cheresh is actually a deaf mute. So I think specifically he's focusing on the inability to talk there and less on the inability to hear.
Yeah, I'm just curious, like, if there's anything in his theology that is about the inability to take in information, because it seems
Interesting.
like this the brokenness, the isolation he's talking about, the sense of being able to speak, but I think it's also about being able to take in information, is that brokenness.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Right. It's not just the inability to speak, but the inability to ask, a brokenness that makes it hard to even receive. Yeah. Right. That's also so interesting because of the dynamic of the Rebbe and the people. For him, it's all about speaking because that's what he's the rabbi. He's talking. For them, you can imagine them sitting around listening. So they're actually, right, the mirror of that could also be significant. Yeah, I haven't seen that addressed explicitly, but it's a very interesting point. So thank you for raising that.
Thanks.
I want to thank everyone so much for joining us again.